Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Healthcare was on the White House agenda today. Big summit to take the pulse of various reform efforts. Health was also on the minds of investors. The health of an auto industry as it struggles with life-threatening conditions. The health of General Electric and rumors of blocked arteries in some of its businesses. And the health of Citibank. Dead bank walking, which briefly became a penny stock today. Too bad the drug industry doesn't have a pill for economics. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue, fresh thinking on the moral, spiritual, and ethical aspects of the economic downturn. Gain perspective at speakingoffaith.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vegland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the fifth day of March. As a general rule, corporate America loathes acknowledging any hint of trouble. We'll be fine, goes the mantra. It'll be okay. Yeah. Bear Stearns, anyone? Lehman? AIG? Well, today one of the big three automakers confirmed something in writing that industry watchers have long suspected, that its future is in, quote, substantial doubt. Ashley Millen-Tite reports on what is next for General Motors.
GM's annual report says the company could end up filing for bankruptcy if a few of its plans don't work out, including the one to get another $16 billion in government loans. Dave Sedgwick is editor of Automotive News. He says the Obama administration will come up with the cash.
Keep in mind that with the jobs market collapsing, just about the last thing you would want to do is to have the nation's largest automaker collapse, drag down hundreds of suppliers with it.
Not to mention, he says, the other car makers that rely on those suppliers and hundreds of dealerships.
On top of that, there's the political issue. The Obama administration is a close ally of the United Auto Workers.
He says filing for bankruptcy would be a last resort. John Blank of Decision Economics agrees.
If they did a Chapter 11 in the most depressed auto sales environment that we've seen in 50 years, it would almost certainly doom the restructured company as much as the one that's in play right now.
He says GM is getting rid of some of its brands, but given the state of the economy,
they cannot get out of this by what basically amounts to a modest repositioning of the company's product portfolio.
Blank says to survive, GM must also slash labor and healthcare costs and persuade its bondholders to take a haircut by swapping their debt for company stock. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
If you want to gauge the deeply conflicted mood of investors these days, just take a look at what's been happening to stock in General Electric this week. For years, decades, the company that makes everything from jet engines to washing machines and light bulbs has been a Wall Street bellwether. GE posted its third highest profit ever last year. But yesterday, the company's share price plunged to its lowest level in almost two decades. It recovered a bit today, but trading has been volatile in the extreme. Analysts point to nagging worries about the company's big financial division, GE Capital. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
In the past 12 months, shareholders have essentially cashed in roughly $224 billion of the huge conglomerate's market value. And this morning, after three straight days of sharp declines, GE's chief financial officer took the rare defensive step of reassuring shareholders in a live appearance on CNBC. Keith Sharon acknowledged investor worries that the company's finance arm might not have enough cash set aside to cover upcoming losses from real estate loans, credit card defaults, and other financial dealings. But he insisted the company isn't hiding a time bomb.
We can basically fund ourselves all the way through 2010 without any issues, and we don't have any short-term liquidity issues. So I think that credit volatility is overdone.
But that didn't stop the naysayers whose criticism has helped drive down the stock in recent days. Stern AG and Leach analyst Nicholas Heyman says GE may indeed have access to enough cash to run itself through next year. But he points out much of it is being borrowed at low rates with the backing of the federal government.
That's the definition of having access to capital. I mean, the government can't guarantee everything for life.
Heyman says since GE isn't officially a government-rescued bank, it can avoid putting a price on its bad assets right away. And he contends that leaves GE with precious little wiggle room, especially with its industrial businesses struggling.
Whereas it's not anything about to go off a cliff, it's tough times. And right now, on its own, without government assistance, it isn't sustainable.
Analysts say it also hasn't helped that GE sprang a surprise dividend cut on shareholders, many of whom have long counted on GE's dividend as a reliable source of income. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, you know that happy music we played yesterday? The tune we had to dig out of the archives? Yeah, never mind. Investors focused on GE, GM, and gee, those retail sales sure were terrible. Oh, and Citigroup fell below a buck a share today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today, President Barack Obama held a healthcare summit at the White House. It was an attempt to deal with one of this country's most intractable problems, a Byzantine, expensive, and often ineffective healthcare system. Fixing that system has been a stated priority for previous administrations. Not much has happened. Marketplace's Steve Henn looks at the chances for real reform this time around.
When President Obama talks about the country's healthcare, two issues come up. 43 million Americans are uninsured, and the staggering price.
By a wide margin, the biggest threat to our nation's balance sheet is the skyrocketing cost of health care. It's not even close. That's why we cannot delay this discussion any longer.
The president said today all reform options except inaction are on the table. But most observers agree Obama's unlikely to propose a government-run single-payer system. Instead, we're likely to see a hybrid.
You know, I think that's where people are headed.
John Shields is a health policy analyst at the Lewin Group and not a fan.
They would actually build on the parts of our healthcare system that perform the most poorly right now.
Shields says that includes expanding Medicaid. He estimates the president's healthcare proposals would raise healthcare costs by $40 billion, but the number of uninsured would fall by half. Advocates say the key will be making healthcare more efficient. Pay providers for patient outcomes instead of for procedures, and require more people to buy coverage. Joseph Antos is a health policy expert at the American Enterprise Institute.
This is a big ship. This isn't a rowboat, so we're not going to be able to change the course of this big ship very quickly.
Antos says the goal of healthcare reform should be to take our lumbering, dysfunctional system and change course slowly, plug the holes, and work over time to bring costs down. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
One of the players at the healthcare reform table is Ronald Williams, the CEO of Aetna Insurance. Williams has been among the most outspoken insurance executives in supporting significant changes to the healthcare system. He spoke with my colleague Kai Rizdahl about some of the issues they'll need to consider during this two-day meeting in Washington.
You have said, as have many, many others, that it is time for change in the American healthcare system, that it's time for a transformation. What do we do? What are the first steps?
I think it really starts with this recognition that we have in excess of 45 million people in the country who are uninsured. And the question is, what types of solutions and ideas can we undertake to help bring them into the system?
Well, the president has said he wants some kind of mandatory universal coverage. Are you buying that?
I have been a strong proponent of getting everyone in the system and keeping everyone covered.
So the government should have the power to make us all go out and buy some kind of insurance. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think if we're going to have a requirement that everyone have equal access to insurance, you really have to have a way to make certain that everyone's expected to participate. There are lots of different mechanisms, and we would leave it to the legislative bodies to figure out the right answers.
Who's going to pay, though, sir?
One, I would say the employer-sponsored system is a huge part. So employers will pay a big part as they do today. I think individuals would pay, and I think there are opportunities to look at the individual households and figure out what the right way to induce funding. We have tax credits we can provide. There are other things we can do.
Where does the role of the private corporation such as yours come in? Are you willing to take a slightly less profit to make sure everybody gets covered?
We think we make a fair and reasonable profit. I think people dramatically overestimate the amount of profit that we make. We make about 6% after tax, which we think is a fair and reasonable number. And we believe if we can bring more people in, that we can be more efficient and really offer them a product at a lower price.
Why is it that this time around in health care reform, 15 years after we tried it with the Clintons, the health insurance industry, companies such as yours, seem to be taking it a lot more seriously, understanding the need for some kind of change?
Well, I think what we're looking at is a recognition that health care costs are increasing dramatically. And I think one of the things important for everyone to understand is that health care premiums are a direct reflection of health care costs. And I like to use the example that it's as if we have a temperature of 104, we take the thermometer and it gives us a reading of 104, and we blame the thermometer for our temperature. The reality is our premiums are reflective, and I think we in the industry understand that unless we collaborate with physicians, with hospitals, with plan sponsors, and with the government and develop private-public partnerships that can slow down the rate of increase, we're looking at health care costs doubling between now and 2017.
To continue with your thermometer analogy there, nobody actually hates their thermometer. I'd venture to say that a lot of people aren't really thrilled with their health care companies.
It's fair to say that we sit in a very difficult intersection. We have the employer who often purchases the health plan, and we go to the employer and we say, you can buy good, you can buy better, or you can buy the absolute best, where your employees will not pay a nickel for anything. And the employer says, you know, I wish I could buy that. So there really are purchase decisions going on there. And then you have the member who, when they select the plan, thinks about their household budget and affordability and perhaps selects a plan that isn't as comprehensive as they would if they knew they were going to be an extensive user of the system.
Ron Williams, the chairman and CEO of Aetna. Mr. Williams, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
American corporate news wasn't the only factor weighing on investors today. Disappointment in China seeped into the markets. Rumor had it Chinese leaders would begin today's annual National People's Congress with a bang in the form of an expanded stimulus package. Didn't happen. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao opened the party Congress. There was polite clapping. There was a prepared speech. There was zilch about additional stimulus. The prime minister did say that Beijing will do everything it can to meet its goal of 8% economic growth this year. That's pretty ambitious. The IMF thinks the entire world will grow by just 0.5%. But ambitious is the point, says Andy Rothman at investment bank CLSA.
The Chinese Communist Party leadership is trying to do the same thing the Obama administration's doing, which is to instill confidence that their government is on top of the problem and is taking the right steps to fix it.
The steps Beijing is taking are different from Washington's. For one, China's $585 billion package relies largely on bank lending, not government spending. State-owned banks here have healthy balance sheets with little exposure to those subprime loans. And more to the point, they're state-controlled banks.
The Chinese Communist Party controls every bank in China, so when the party tells bankers to lend, their only question is how much.
Lend first, ask questions later. That approach is made for record lending in January, 1,000% more than in the previous year. Now, much of that money will go to pour concrete. China's economy thrives on building stuff, as opposed to the U.S., which runs on people buying stuff. Economist Wang Tao is with UBS Securities.
The U.S. is a more consumption-led economy, so more of the government stimulus is focusing on giving the consumers more money to spend. Whereas China, the focus is much more on investment.
As China invests in new roads and train tracks, it'll import stuff like bulldozers from the U.S. and iron ore from Australia, a little boost to the world economy. But it won't help create jobs at home for laid-off Chinese factory workers. Economist Geng Xiao is with the Brookings Institution.
We are talking about 30 million lost jobs for migrant workers, you know, which is 10 times bigger than the unemployment in the U.S.
Xiao expects Chinese job numbers to get worse this spring, and that fear is being heard loud and clear at this party Congress. One top official pleaded with Chinese companies not to lay people off. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, life in the fast lane slows down in Dubai.
So now, instead of being able to enjoy my fast car, I'm instead desperately trying to get it off my hands. And it was one of the reasons that I am, unfortunately, at the moment, having a lot of financial difficulties.
But first, let's do the numbers. Another day, another triple-digit move on the Dow. It took a big hit, falling 281 points, 4% to finish at 6,594. The Nasdaq dropped by 54 points, also 4%, to close at 1299. The S&P slid 30 points, 4.25%, to end the day at 682. Financials tugged the markets lower. Citigroup lost 9%, and as we said, its stock value briefly dipped below the $1 mark for the first time. Wells Fargo dropped almost 16% today. JPMorgan Chase fell by 14%. The dire news from General Motors pushed GM stock down 15%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.81%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for February. The Federal Reserve Board releases its consumer credit report for January. And the third annual National Emergency Management Summit concludes in the nation's capital. It aims to increase knowledge on how we can best prepare for disasters. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. At this point, Wall Street bankers are probably getting used to all the criticism of their giant paychecks. Same goes for corporate chieftains. In fact, late yesterday, New York's attorney general subpoenaed seven Merrill Lynch executives over those multi-million dollar bonuses they got last year. Who is not used to these kinds of salary questions? College sports coaches. Here to discuss is our business of sports commentator, Diana Nyad. Hey, Diana.
How you doing, Tess?
Doing all right. Great to see you again.
Thank you.
Let's talk about a little video that made a pretty big splash a few days ago. The coach of the UConn basketball team was asked a question about his salary, which is quite high at a time when universities across the country are cutting budgets. What do you make of all this?
The activist, we'll call him too, that's who shouted out this question at this
right.
press conference of Jim Calhoun, who's the men's basketball coach at UConn, you know, shouted out, well, you know, you're making $1.6 million. How dare you when, forget about universities cutting budgets, the state of Connecticut is in dire straits. Their deficits are enormous. How dare you take that money? And Jim Calhoun yelled back, how dare you ask me that question? Do you have any idea what I and my program brings in to these universities? So, the crux of the issue we're talking about today is there are 39 private universities around the country where the basketball coach, the football coach, the AD make much more than the president of the university. Is it fair? Is it right? I don't know. But as a business model, it's what comes down.
Well, let me turn it around on you. I mean, was this a fair question, especially in this economy?
Well, you know, fair or not, it was ignorant. Because as Jim Calhoun said, he missaid the basketball program at UConn brings in $12 million to the university. It actually brings in seven. So he wasn't
still counting a pretty big figure.
More than any other department, of course, at right. the university. So, you know, there was an Auburn model of a couple of years ago where the coach and all his assistant coaches were making about $5 million. But they're bringing in 10 times that in revenue. So they're only taking one-tenth of the revenue. And nine-tenths of it goes back to the program, which, by the way— pays for that head coach, like this activist who yelled out, says, the taxpayers are paying your salary. I don't want to pay your salary. Well, guess what? He's not paying that salary. It's the percentage of the ticket sales. It's the sneaker deals. It's, you know, all these coaches have their local radio and television programs every week. And so that's the money that pays for their salaries. Taxpayer doesn't pay a dime of it.
And I wonder if there's also a follow-on effect. These universities hire these coaches to create winning teams. And winning teams, in turn, can bring in alumni donations. Whether you like that or not, it is a factor in people donating to their alma maters.
That's true. And it's not just the alumni. Georgia Tech is a good example. In the state of Georgia, the names that you would know best are the people at the head coaches and the players at Georgia Tech, at University of Georgia, right. You know, and we could go state by state. Not that we don't know some senators' names and some, you know, and some political activists, but honestly, the public looks to those faces in the athletic departments as the main personalities of the entire state.
So is this a false controversy?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. I mean, I used to, you know, argue against the salaries that these head coaches made just on principle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the crazy Groucho Marx quote was something to the effect of how, you know, how's a university, how are we going to support financially both the academics and the athletics? And Groucho Marx says we can't burn down the library. Just meaning that if we're looking at a financial model, and unfortunately you have to, it, you know, it works and the coaches get what they should get. And it is a non-issue.
Diana, thanks so much. Good to see you again.
You too, Tess.
For much of the last decade, Dubai was synonymous with financial success and extravagant consumption, swanky real estate, posh shopping malls. The tiny emirate has drawn rich tourists and investors from around the world. But these days, even Dubai is hurting. Property prices are plunging. Tens of thousands of expats are scurrying out of town. And in a country where more than 90% of the population is from somewhere else, that could mean trouble. From Dubai, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the first of two reports.
In a car park under one of Dubai's gleaming skyscrapers, Raja Khoury, a 27-year-old from Lebanon, shows me his new sports car with mixed feelings.
So this is her. She purrs nicely and was a symbol of where I was going. Now it's a symbol of where I didn't go.
Raja was drawn to Dubai 18 months ago by the glamorous freewheeling lifestyle. He got a job with a real estate firm, was promoted, and borrowed $25,000 to buy the car. A few weeks later, he was laid off.
So now, instead of being able to enjoy my fast car, I'm instead desperately trying to get it off my hands. And it was one of the reasons that I am, unfortunately, at the moment, having a lot of financial difficulties.
Revving up in the car park, Raja admits he's going nowhere fast. He can't find another job and is having trouble selling the car. Raja should be worried, says Mohammed Goubesh of the local Human Rights Association. Dubai has some old-fashioned ideas about debt.
If I default on my car loan, I go to jail. I think it's utterly stupid, and we really should change these practices. It is such draconian old laws that we really need to reform.
That might explain why several thousand expats have reportedly fled the emirate, abandoning their part-paid vehicles at the airport. The government denies that story, but there's little doubt that expats here are no longer living the dream.
Dubai has created a haven for property buying. No income tax, no capital gains tax, no VAT.
Hundreds of thousands of foreigners have been enticed to settle here, but now the economy is turning down. They're discovering another harsh fact of life in Dubai. If they lose their jobs, their visas will be cancelled and they'll have to get out in 30 days. The government won't confirm how many visas have been revoked or how many expats have left, but it feels as if many thousands have gone. I'm on the city's main drag, Sheikh Zayed Road. It's rush hour. traffic is whizzing past. A year ago, this would have been a gigantic jam. There are clearly far fewer cars on the road. Many Dubaian citizens seem happy about that. And even human rights activist Mohamed Ghoubeish is relaxed about expats being told to leave.
If the country doesn't have the jobs anymore, what else can it do but to ask everyone to go back home until, the economy improves and then conditions are there for them to come back.
But some of the expats who've been laid off and then turfed out, like this Indian advertising copywriter, say they're very unlikely to return.
I don't think I would like to come back here because to not feel wanted is a feeling that you really can't get rid of so easily. It will be a difficult decision for me to come back here.
And Raja Khoury, the expat from Lebanon, says Dubai attracted young, talented people from all over the world. It was a haven of hope in the economically stagnant Middle East. It'll never be the same again.
Dubai had such a hot image to it, such a good global image in terms of the place for people to go. It's the new world, you know, the new model for, you know, successful markets. The idea that Dubai is this haven is gone. And I do not see it coming back.
The shopping malls are quieter. Sleek young male Dubaians sashay through wearing their immaculate white gowns. They seem more confident now that many of the foreigners are leaving. Some of them say, we're getting our country back. But Dubai's prosperity depends on the expats. They bought or rented the luxury flats, filled the shops, patronised the restaurants, ran the economy. If too many of them leave, the emirate really could be in trouble. In Dubai, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And tomorrow, Stephen visits some of the low-paid construction workers who helped build the towering symbols of Dubai's boom years.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, another economic record fell today. 31.8 million Americans are now on food stamps. The Food Research and Action Center says the number of recipients grew by 700,000 in just 1 month. The current benefit is $115 a month per person. That amount will rise by 13% in April under the recent stimulus package. The center says Texas has the largest number of food stamp recipients, more than 3 million. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 281 points, 4%. The Nasdaq fell 54 points, also 4%. And the S&P 500 lost 29 points, 4.1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, a lot of us hope our jobs will get better as we advance.
Whereas mine, in hindsight, have been good, okay, bad, none.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.